The horses were waiting at Razeris, and they picked up relays of mules as they journeyed through the foothills of the Abyssinian highlands. They reached Entoto after 11 days of hard going, and as they rode into the courtyard of Rider Courtney's compound, Saffron rushed out to greet her twin. Amber tumbled off her mule, and they fell into each other's arms, too overcome to speak. Rider watched them from the veranda with a benign smile. Once they had recovered their tongues, the twins could barely pause to draw breath. They sat up all night in Saffron's studio talking. They wandered hand in hand through the souks and lanes of Entoto, talking. They rode out into the mountains and came back with armfuls of flowers, still talking. Then they read their father's journal aloud to each other, and Rebecca's additions to it, and they hugged each other as they wept for their father and elder sister, both of whom they had lost forever. Amber studied Saffron's portfolio of cartoon sketches. She pronounced them wonderfully accurate and evocative, then suggested a few small changes and improvements, which Saffron, anxious to please her, adopted immediately. Saffron designed and made a complete wardrobe of new clothes for Amber, and took her to have tea with Lady Alice Packer and Empress Miriam. The Queen thought Amber's new outfit stylish and fetching, and asked Saffron to design her a dress for the next state dinner. Amber continued David Benbrook's journal from the point where Rebecca had left off. In it, she described her escape from Omdurman and the flight up the Blue Nile to the Abyssinian border. In the process, she discovered she had a natural talent with the written word. Only Ryder was not completely enchanted by Amber's arrival in Entoto. He had become accustomed to having Saffron's undivided attention. Now that it had been diverted to her twin, he realized, with something of a shock, how much he missed it. Penrod recovered swiftly from the injuries he had suffered in Osman Atalan's Sheba. He exercised his sword arm in practice with Jakob and his legs in long solitary walks in the mountains. His first urgent duty was to report his actions and whereabouts to his superiors in Cairo, but the telegraph line ran only as far as Djibouti on the Gulf of Aden. He wrote letters to Sir Evelyn Baring and Viscount Wolseley, and to his elder brother in England. The British ambassador sent these out in the diplomatic pouch, but they all knew how long it would be before he could expect a reply. Ryder Courtney had a sealed blank envelope for Penrod. When Penrod weighed it in his hand, he realized that it contained more than paper. "Who is it from?" he asked. "Regrettably, I have been sworn to silence," Ryder replied, "but I am sure the answer is contained in it. You must ask nothing more from me concerning the matter, for I am unable to discuss it." Penrod took it to the bedroom that Ryder had set aside for him and bolted the door. As he slit open the envelope, a weighty object fell out, but he caught it before it struck the tiles. It lay in his palm, shimmering, gold and magnificent, its beauty undiminished by the ages. On the obverse side was the crowned portrait of Cleopatra Thea Philopater, and on the reverse the head of Marcus Antonius. In the envelope with the coin was a single line of Arabic written on parchment. "When my lord needs me, he knows where I shall be." The coin was her signature. "Bakita." He rubbed the portrait of the woman with his thumb. How did she fit into the scheme of things now? Then he remembered Jakob trying to tell him something important while he was drugged with laudanum on the first night of the escape from Omdurman. The next day he and Jakob rode up into the mountains where they could be alone. Jakob related in detail how, after Penrod had been captured by Osman Atalan, he had set out for Aswan to enlist the aid of the only person who could and would help them. He explained how he had been arrested on the Egyptian border while travelling with a dealer in slaves, and how he had been imprisoned for over a year before he could go on to Aswan. "As soon as I found Bakita al-Masur, she travelled with me here to Entoto and arranged your escape with al-Sakawi." Penrod considered ignoring Ryder Courtney's warning and taxing him with Bakita's role in their rescue, but in the end he shied away from doing so. He and Bakita had always maintained the greatest secrecy and discretion in their relationship. It even surprised him that Jakob had known of it. "By this time I should have learnt not to be surprised by anything that the intrepid Jakob comes up with," he smiled to himself. Then he considered writing to Bakita, but this would be equally unwise. Even if the letter went through diplomatic channels, there was no telling which of the embassy staff was in the pay of the ubiquitous Evelyn Baring. There was another reason not to contact Makita. This was less clear-cut in his mind, but it had to do with Amber Benbrook. He did not want to do anything that might later hurt the child. Child! He questioned his choice of word as he watched her across the yard in deep conversation with her twin sister. You deceive yourself, Penrod Ballantyne. It was 5 months before Penrod received a reply to the letter he had written to his elder brother, Sir Peter Ballantyne, at the family estate on the Scottish borders. In his reply, Sir Peter agreed that the Benbrook sisters might make their home at Clarecastle until such time as their future had been decided. Penrod would sail back to England with Amber and Saffron and take care of them until they reached Clarecastle. Once they arrived, Sir Peter's wife Jane would take over the responsibility from him. As soon as Penrod received his brother's letter, he went up to the British Embassy and telegraphed to the office of the Peninsular and Orient Steamship Line in Djibouti. He booked passage for himself and the twins on board the SS Singapore, sailing via Suez and Alexandria for Southampton in 6 weeks' time. When Amber learnt that she would be sailing home in company with Penrod Ballantyne, then staying at Clarecastle with the Ballantyne family, she made no objection. On the contrary, she seemed well pleased with the arrangement. It did not go so easily with the other twin. There followed long and difficult discussions with Saffron, who announced with passion that she could see no reason why she should return to England, where it rains all the time and I shall probably expire with double pneumonia on the same day I arrive. It was necessary to appeal to Alice Packer for a ruling. My dear Saffron, you are only 14. 15 in a month's time, Saffron corrected her grimly. Your education has been somewhat neglected, Alice went on imperturbably. I am sure Sir Peter will provide a governess for you, and Amber. After all, he has daughters of very much the same age as you two, darling girls. I don't need geography and mathematics, said Saffron stubbornly. I know all about Africa, and I can paint. Ah, said Alice. Sir John Millais is a dear friend of mine. How would you like to study art under him? I'm sure I can arrange it. Saffron wavered. Millais was a founder of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, the most celebrated painter of the day. David Benbrook had kept a book of his paintings in his study at Khartoum. Saffron had spent hours dreaming over them. Then Alice played her trump. And, of course, as soon as you are 16, you will always be welcome to return to Entoto as my guest, whenever and as often as you wish. As the day of their departure for Djibouti drew nearer, Saffron spent less time with her twin and more in helping Bakshit look after Ryder. He agreed to pose for an hour or two each evening for one last portrait. Since the twins' future had been agreed upon, his mood had been subdued, but it lightened perceptibly during these daily painting sessions. Saffron was an amusing girl and made him laugh. 2 days before Penrod and the twins were due to leave Entoto for Djibouti, Ryder announced his intention of joining their little caravan, as he was expecting a shipment of trade goods to arrive on board the SS Singapore from Calcutta. During the journey down to the coast, Ryder and Saffron spent much time riding side by side at the rear of the convoy. The closer they came to Djibouti, the more serious their expressions became. The day before they came in sight of the town and harbour, a flaming row broke out between them. Saffron left Ryder and galloped to the head of the column to ride beside Amber. That night, as was the custom, the four of them ate supper beside the fire. When Ryder addressed a polite remark to her, Saffron pulled a face and deliberately moved her chair so that her back was turned to him. She did not bid him good night when she and Amber went to their tent. The next day, as they came in sight of Djibouti Harbour, the SS Singapore was lying in the roads and discharging cargo into the lighters clustered around her. While Ryder and Bakshit set up camp on the outskirts of the town, Penrod and the twins rode down to the shipping office at the wharf to pay for and receive their tickets for the voyage to Southampton. The shipping clerk assured them that the Singapore would sail on schedule at noon the following day. Penrod managed to buy a bottle of Glenlivet whiskey from the purser. He and Ryder made short work of it that evening, when the twins had retired to their tent not long after nightfall. Due to the exigencies of the previous evening's consumption of liquor, the two men were late in rising. In the roads, the Singapore was already making steam in preparation for her sailing in 3 hours' time. Penrod took the luggage down to the wharf and sent it on board, then rowed back to the camp and found it in a state of uproar. "She has gone," Bakshit lamented and wrung his plump hands. "Phil has gone." "What do you mean, Bakshit? Where has she gone?" "We do not know, Effendi. During the night she took her mule and rode away. Al-Sakawi has gone after her, but I think Phil has 6 hours' start on him. He won't be able to catch her before nightfall." "By that time the Singapore will have sailed," Penrod fumed, and went to find Amber. "After Saffron and I climbed into bed, I went to sleep directly. When I woke, it was already light, and Safi had gone, just like that, without even a goodbye." Penrod studied her face for some hint of the truth. He was sure he had heard the twins whispering when he had passed their tent on the way to his own bed. He knew for certain it had been after midnight, because he had wound his pocket watch before he blew out the lamp. "Oh, well, we'll have to go on board. We cannot miss this sailing. There will not be another for months. I will try to persuade the captain to delay until Saffron is on board," he said, and Amber agreed with an angelic expression. While Penrod and Amber stood at the starboard rail of the Singapore, Penrod was staring anxiously through a pair of borrowed binoculars as the last boat from the shore approached the ship's side. "Blue bloody blazes," he muttered furiously. "She isn't on board." As he lowered the binoculars, the ship's third officer hurried down the ladder from the bridge and came to them. "Captain's compliments, Captain Ballantyne, but he very much regrets that he's not able to delay the sailing until the arrival of Miss Benbrook. If he does, he'll be unable to make his reservation for the transit of the Suez Canal." Just then the ship's siren wailed and cut off the rest of his apology. The capstan in the bows began to clatter, and the anchor broke free. "Now, Miss Amber Benbrook," Penrod said grimly, "I think it's time you delivered the truth. Just what is your sister playing at?"
"I should think it's perfectly obvious, Captain Ballantyne, except to a blind man or an imbecile."
"Nevertheless, I would be most obliged if you could explain it to me."
"My sister is in love with Mr. Ryder Courtney. She has not the slightest intention of leaving him. I'm afraid we are to be deprived of her company on this voyage. You will have to make do with mine."
A prospect that I do not find particularly distressing, he thought, but tried to disguise his pleasure.